Before we start, we'd like to thank Andy Brick and Ricard Falk for their reviews on Podchaser and iTunes, respectively. It's support like this that really encourages us in what we do.
Good day, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of The Coriolis Effect. If you go down to the woods today, you're in for a big surprise. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew. And I thought we were going to say, if you go down to the woods alone, you'll be in for a big surprise.
Alone? Okay, well, all right. If you go down to the woods alone, you're in for a big surprise.
I said, don't sing it!
Too late.
This is a very exciting moment for us. This is the first time we've recorded this face to face. This magazine.
Other than when we're in Sweden, actually.
Oh, we did that as well. Yeah. No, this is the second time we've recorded this face to face.
And here we are, holding hands, sipping coffee. First thing on whatever day is Saturday morning.
Yeah, I'm not sipping coffee. You wouldn't get me coffee.
No, that's true. I didn't ask for coffee.
Actually expressly said I didn't want any coffee.
Yes. So stop complaining that you haven't got any coffee.
Moving on, because we want to keep this episode really short.
We do need to keep this episode short.
This is preceding our upcoming game of Savage Worlds of Solomon Kane.
Solomon Kane, yep.
And the others are going to arrive soon. That's not something we're going to record for you, because it's being Savage Worlds. It's not in the oeuvre or the remit of this programme. But what is within the remit of this programme is a little summary of the world of gaming. And we're going to be, I think, looking forward to... What are we looking forward to in 2019?
Looking forward to what we're looking forward to.
Yeah, that's what we're going to be doing.
Did you plan that line?
That's my script. That's what my script says. In fact, we've taken a cue from the internet, because, David, you came woefully unprepared to this at the beginning of the week. And you said, I haven't got anything for my article.
No, I was. It's been frantically busy. I have a new member of my household, my lovely little German Shepherd puppy called Diggy, who is gorgeous, but is huge and is quite lively.
Yeah, she's quite big.
She's huge.
A small dog.
She's going to be, her parents are enormous.
Enormous.
So, Falco, her dad, is like a bloody werewolf. He's absolutely huge. If you've seen American Werewolf in London, and you've seen the bit where the werewolf is in the underground, going after the guy who eats on the escalator. That's Falco. Except Falco is the most beautiful, lovely dog ever.
Now, I'm just realising now why you bought this damned puppy. Because I happen to know that you're a bit of a scholar of Roman history. And I wonder whether you're a fan of those Roman detective stories featuring a Roman detective called Falco.
I think I've read one of them. I'm not such a big fan of that sort of fiction, really.
Okay, so I'll let you off. I was going to say you only bought this puppy because his dad was called Falco.
No.
anyway, we're getting a bit distracted here. We're going to be talking about Forbidden Lands. And what we're going to be talking about is a thing that we saw on the internet this week, which came from... It's like Jonathan Friendship or something.
Let's have a look. The question was, Tom Pleasant asked the question.
That's it.
Jonathan Friendship, you muppet.
So, Jonathan... Tom Pleasant raised a question in a couple of places on the internet, Google Plus and I think Facebook. His girlfriend wants to play Forbidden Lands with him, but she wants to do a kind of one-on-one or duet scenario. So I challenge you to think, what advice would we give to somebody who wanted to play one-on-one Forbidden Lands? So we're going to listen to that in a while.
Yep.
And probably then have a bit of an argument about it, because I'm sure you're wrong, Dave. Whatever you've said, I'm sure you're wrong. And then
see what I have to put up with?
Yeah. But you only have to put up with it live just once.
Just once a year, maybe,
And then... we're going to be talking about the creatures that some of you who listen to the AP may already, as we speak, may already have heard in episode 5 of Song to the Siren, most recent Coriolis actual play, and how reading the rule book actually gave me inspiration not to just take a creature out of the rule book, but it gave me a whole bunch of inspiration. We'll talk about that in a while. And then we thought, very shortly, Friel Again are going to be releasing the open gaming license for the Year Zero engine, and we thought we might just speculate about that for a while.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
I only have good ideas, mate. On the other hand,
in your little world, Matthew,
we said we'd start off. We're talking about the world of gaming. There's not much news in January. There aren't many people releasing new stuff in January, or even actually starting all that many Kickstarters. So let's talk about what we're looking forward to. What are you looking forward to, Dave, in the coming year?
Well, actually, I'm going to do a little bit of slightly backward looking as well, and slightly out of the RPG genre, just to reflect on something that I'm really enjoying at the moment. So I backed a board game called Nemesis, which I think I've talked about before.
Which is a
board game which is in effect Alien, and you play a character and you wake up in the hibernatorium, as they call it, with one of your crew members dead, obviously chest bursted, and then you then run the game. And I got that just before Christmas, and it's just brilliant. It's just really good. So it's a semi-cooperative game where you can play cooperatively, but everyone has objectives that they need to fulfill for them to personally win. And those objectives can be against the interests of the other players. So it can be that, you know, one of the other players has to die, or
you're a robot and you've got to get this alien back home so it can be turned into a machine of war.
Yeah, exactly. And it's brilliant. So I've played three games so far and one solo game, which I actually played on Facebook. Somebody was talking about a thing called Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah, I'm aware of that
thing. I'd never come across that before, but I downloaded it on Steam and I played my first game of Nemesis on it yesterday, solo. And I was doing really well. I was a soldier, which is a good one, because obviously, you know, difficult.
You can do things with guns.
Exactly, and you're quite tough in that sense. And I was doing really well, and I'd got both my objectives done almost in the first three or four turns, and all I had to do was survive until I could get back into the
hyper sleep. And save the cat, of course. You had to save the cat, don't you?
I think the cat doesn't exist in this one. Well, there is no cat. There should have been, actually. That would have been...
Game. I'm not going to play it. There's no cat.
Oh, well, because it's called Jones.
Obviously.
I think that was a reason to leave it to die. But then the game is designed to make it really difficult to win. And we had another game the other day where I totally failed my objective, but I was in the escape pod and about to go. And I then locked the other escape pod just before Tony got in it, so he couldn't win. He'd done his objectives and he was running back to the escape pod, and I locked it and I blasted off in the other one. So he hasn't forgiven me for that yet. But I just wanted to say, I know it's not a role-playing game, but it's a board game that is just really great fun. And it's got a lot of hype at the moment, and I think there are some people sort of scratching their heads as to why it's so hyped. But it's a great game.
Great big box. I just saw it when I came in downstairs. is it one of those that's got all those lovely models that
they do
on Kickstarters? And it's got, in fact, more models than it really needs because of all the Kickstarter stretch goals.
Has it got more models than it needs? No, not really, actually, because you can have... You've got, I think, at least four, maybe six adult models, and you can get that many adults on the board.
Right, okay.
The thing I thought... When I first saw it, the models for the crew are your normal sort of, like, I don't know, inch and a half, two-inch size. And the models for the aliens are just fucking huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, the queen is probably 4 inches tall, maybe a bit more, 5. And I just thought, hang on, this would look so much better if it was just a bit smaller.
Oh, really?
But I've got over that. That was just my first impression on the first game. Doesn't, you know, I'm quibbling.
Yeah, you do quibble, though.
I'm a master quibbler.
Okay. So that was your Christmas present to yourself then, I guess, if it was delivered...
One of many.
...just before Christmas. Yeah.
But it's a great game. So I recommend it to anybody if they're interested in that sort of thing. It's a strong recommendation for me.
And I guess that sort of, as you talk about, you know, cooperative, but also with your own objectives, it's kind of role-playing-y as well.
A little bit,
isn't it?
Even
though it's a board game. It sits within a very tight sandbox.
It does.
A very small sandbox where you can only do certain things.
And the way it works is that the ship, even though there will be a core set of rooms on the ship that will always be there, you don't know where they are. So
right.
You randomly place them, and then you have to... The idea is that when you come out of hypersleep, you're a bit disoriented. You don't remember where everything is. You know where the engines are and the cockpit is, but that's it. And everything else, you have to go and remind yourself. You have to find it again. Because you've sort of been dumped out of hypersleep so quickly. But that's good. So it makes it enormously replayable in that sense.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So what are you looking forward to?
So what I'm really looking forward to is Western, actually. I am dying to do a Western. And I'll tell you what, I was reminded of a bit of music that our friends at Happy Jack's RPG podcast do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just give them a buzz. And I've gone quiet.
So speak up.
Yeah, no, turning my face away from the mic to look out of the window doesn't
work. No, it doesn't. Again, professionalism.
So where was I? Yes.
Happy Jacks.
I want Western to arrive. You said you'd run a game. I want you to run a game. I want to be a cowboy or some sort of Western character. And I want it to be a proper Old West game. And I want there to be no ninjas in it. And Happy Jacks have got a little theme tune that would be perfect for... They hardly ever play this theme tune, but it's called No, You Can't Be a Ninja. This is an old west game, and they didn't have ninjas. And
so my list of things to be in my campaign: ninjas,
no ninjas, no ninjas,
werewolves,
no vampires, no ninjas, no werewolves, no vampires. I want the cold, hard environment and evil men, or men with their own motivations, and women, of course. And guns. That's all I want in my Western.
Well, my inspiration for any campaign will be Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which is...
Now, I've read a few of his works, just but not... So, is that a Western?
It's a Western one. It's about scalp hunters.
Ah.
And it is bitter.
Did somebody make a film of it?
I don't know. Probably some. I haven't seen one.
I vaguely know those two words put together.
Yeah.
But I've not seen a book of it.
But it's held up as a really good example of sort of recreating what it was really like.
Mm.
And it is just bitter and horrible. And the lives that those people went through is just so tough. Yeah.
Not as tough as they went through in The Road, though.
I haven't read The Road.
Have you not read The Road?
No, that's a post-apocalyptic one, isn't it?
It's post-apocalyptic, yeah. And it's the most depressing post-apocalyptic work.
Yeah, that's father and son thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know that game where I said, fuck it, we're all going to die anyway, that you ran your post-apocalyptic game?
Yes.
That was my attitude after having read
that. Yeah, Tony, my brother Tony, is very sentimental when it comes to father-son things.
Mm.
And I think he watched the film or read the book and just spent a month crying, I think.
It's a tough old read.
Yeah.
I remember reading
Blood Meridian is a tough old read as well. Yeah.
Okay, right. Well,
but I'm definitely up for that. I still don't have any sense really when it's going to arrive through my door. I mean, obviously there's loads of reasons why it's delayed. And I'm not decrying any of those, of course. But any kind of sense when I could just get the core book through the door would be nice.
Yeah, I would like to get a core book through the door this year. I think that's what I'm saying I'm looking forward to it.
I think I'm in the mood to do something different. We were talking the other day. So my Simba Room campaign, which I'm enjoying, and I love the characters. I mean, we've had long discussions about our concerns about the game mechanics and the rule system.
Mm-hmm.
But the game itself is great, and the characters we've got are brilliant. But I'm kind of in the mood for doing something new. And I've talked about doing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 4th Edition, which I got for Christmas as well.
Yeah. Is that one you bought yourself for Christmas again?
I bought it myself and I gave it to my wife to wrap up.
Excellent.
Which is really the best.
Good. So your wife gave it to you.
Yes, of course.
But she actually did the act of giving.
The act of wrapping.
Choosing.
Yes. The act of buying.
Yeah.
Was all mine. So I'll talk to you guys about it, about whether I run that for a while. But yeah, Western is kind of the next one that's on my list of things to do.
So we want it to come quickly so that I don't have to play Warhammer 40K. Not Warhammer 40K, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay.
Did you not want to play Fantasy Roleplay?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to have this discussion offline. I think my text to you was maybe.
It's like when my wife's Swedish and when we first got together, there was a real translation thing between us and what the Swedes understand what we mean by when we say things. So, for example, you know, us English people, if somebody says, oh, do you want to do such and such? And you go, could do. That absolutely means, oh, for fuck's sake, no. God, I'd rather have my nuts boiled in marmalade than do that. But to a Swede, could do means what it says. It means, we could do that. And it took us about 5 years before we got that translation.
I think I remain to be persuaded, and maybe we'll take an opportunity to look through your rule book today and see whether it does.
Or we could do something else. I mean, I think I'm kind of losing a bit of inspiration for my Simbarim campaign.
Well, you see, and I wonder whether a change of genre into something like Western would be the ideal
thing. I agree, but I don't have the book. So.
Or maybe we could just put all your games towards the end of the year.
And that's an option, run actually.
Run Lands or something. Yeah. A bit. Okay. But we'll talk about that.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Anything else? Oh, the other thing, of course, that's coming out from Kickstarter, I know not when because I'm only a PDF.
Is this Things from the Flood?
Things from the Flood.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm not sure when that's due to deliver this year. Mm. Oh, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. That'll be...
Maybe you should run some more Tales from the Loop.
I could do that,
yeah. And then we could go through that adventure and be ready to be teenagers and get killed by you in Things of the Flood when that comes out.
But then I'm not running Western, am I, if I'm running...
Well, except we haven't got Western yet. But I'm just saying, if you want to change from...
That's not a terrible idea, actually, yeah. Not a terrible idea at all. I'm also feeling the urge to change what I'm running for my weekly group as well. So I'm doing Simbarim. I'm doing Coriolis.
Yeah.
For various reasons, we haven't played as frequently as we had done normally. Yeah. And I've got an idea how I can run the campaign through, but I just wonder whether it might be a good idea to mix up and do something. Maybe Forbidden Lands, possibly. Mm. I haven't spoken to the guys about it yet, and I would quite like to get to a point in the Coriolis campaign that it's a sensible point to stop.
Yeah.
Which we're not at the moment, but another thought. But Things from the Flood, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. Tales from the Loop, but being able to kill the kids, that gets my vote, absolutely.
Right, okay, I'll look forward to that, I think.
What else? Is there anything else?
Not particularly that I'm massively looking forward to. I've got another game, interestingly, that I backed on Kickstarter, again, at a relatively low level, but it sounded fascinating, and that's called Flying Circus.
Okay.
And it's Tales from the Apocalypse. Sorry, not Tales. Powered by the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Powered game. And it's a kind of mix of... Have you seen those Studio Ghibli films about flying pigs? I think Porco Rosso?
No, I haven't.
I mean, flying pigs as in they don't actually fly, because as we know, pigs don't fly. but they can be excellent pilots in Porco Rosso. Okay. So it's a sort of mix of World War I style aeroplanes... Okay. Flying over a sort of fantasy Middle European thing, which the guy behind Studio Ghibli was always mad on. I mean, that's why it's called Studio Ghibli. That's an Italian car make or something from the early part of the 20th century. So this is a sort of weird fantasy pilots versus dragons in a sort of Middle European Germany.
You like all the really...
Weird
stuff that you could only imagine if you're having a bad trip.
Yeah, I guess so. but it's weird for a Powered by the Apocalypse game in that it's quite crunchy when it comes to flying, but they've got some fascinating sort of... The way the rule system works around flying and having dogfights looks really, really interesting.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, I saw it, backed it, and that's just one thing I'm kind of looking forward to, but with no intention of playing. Of course, actually, we have got to play... Something you're really looking forward to. My wife genuinely actually bought me a role-playing game for Christmas.
Out of the blue?
Didn't just wrap it.
Okay.
And
was it her idea or did you give her the idea?
I might have hinted towards it, I guess. but she did the ordering. It came from Games Law and it is Phoenix Dawn Command.
Okay.
Which you and I have spoken about.
We have.
And it's a lovely card-based mechanic, which I know you love. love those cards.
I'm warming to them, actually. I'm not as bad about cards as I used to be this time last year.
So I'd like to try a one-shot of that.
Yeah,
at least.
That sounds good.
I mean, obviously, I'm dedicated to playing Forbidden Lands,
you should be.
We know our listeners want to listen to this.
Yeah, and your players want to play it.
Yeah, and the players want to play it. So that will be... The very next game that I run will definitely be a Forbidden Lands, but maybe later on, once we've got a few of those under our belt and plenty to listen to, we'll crack open Phoenix Dawn Command.
Yeah, I'm up for a game of that. I'm also really keen to play the Rabbits at Passchendaele that you keep talking about. That'd be an interesting one shot as well.
Right, we should have to plan that, and that might be a good one to record as well.
It would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Okay, cool. So let's crack on. Forbidden Lands. Now, you and I, we're really lucky because we've got a little team of people. I'd like actually our little, you know, we play with three players and me. And three players have been, I mean, I think we're triply blessed in that we have three players who know how each other plays. And yeah. I think we play to each other's strength. I mean, people, Guy, the other two, I think, let you talk too much, but...
well, actually, I mean, it's a good point, though. I mean, Andy, I think they let you talk too much as well when you're playing.
Well, this is why, in Simba Room, I'm playing somebody who's mute, actually. Yeah.
Which is then equally frustrating, if not more so, in fact. Because I think both Tony and Andy are quite... They're not really the push themselves into the front kind of people.
No.
They're quite happy to go along and then you know, react off others, I think. And I'm quite mouthy.
Isn't it surprising then that the two of us who talk the most are the ones who run the podcast?
Funny that.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, this is getting a little bit off the topic.
Yeah.
We're blessed. We've got people to play with, or rather, as you say, more than one people to play with. But if you're sitting there with a copy of Forbidden Lands and only one other person to talk to, or play a game with, how are you going to run that?
Indeed.
Let's have a listen to what your thoughts are, Dave.
Let's do that. I guess, at one time or another, we have all fallen foul of having a great game we want to play, but no one to play it with. Some of us are lucky to have good groups of friends to roleplay with, but there have been a couple of times over my 40 years of playing where that hasn't been the case, and I've played and GM'd games with only one player character. Obviously, role-playing is at its best when a group of characters are working and growing together, and playing with only one player brings up a few issues to bear in mind. But for me, it certainly doesn't mean that the player and the GM can't still have a great time. After all, Matthew keeps banging on that the GM is a player too, and some of my best role-playing moments have been between my character and an NPC played by the GM. This question has come up recently in relation to Forbidden Lands, and I think there are a few ways you could handle it. The first thing I'll say is this. Year Zero games are tough and unforgiving. Death is always just one or two dodgy dice rolls away and can happen very fast. And being alone might make staying alive in the Forbidden Lands even harder. So you could allow the player to play multiple characters. One of my earliest role-playing experiences, when I was 10 or 11, was playing D&D with my brother as GM. He ran the module Q1, the Queen of the Demon Web Pits, and I played five characters. I still remember it 40 years on, and it was great. But that said, my preference is for role-playing just one character, for all the various reasons we all know. So how about allies, henchmen and servants? They allow you to focus your attention on your PC, while having the backup of other characters, and remove some of the problems of travelling through the Forbidden Lands on your lonesome. Also, it can be great fun for a player to build up their little coterie or entourage, and how you behave towards them, how you came to have them in your employ, and how you reward them all plays into an exciting wider story without diluting the top billing of your actual character. Have you enslaved them, dominating them so they do your bidding without thought of resistance? This might work well most of the time, but how hard will they try to pull your unconscious and bleeding body from the clutches of some beastly creature in a dark dungeon? Or will they just run and leave you to die? Or will they actively connive at your downfall? After all, living under the yoke won't be fun, and they might actually want their freedom, and to see you fall. Or are you too kind to them? Will they be loyal for your kindness? Or will they see it as weakness and take advantage? The idea of having henchmen is one I really like in Forbidden Lands, and it's certainly not just for one-player games. But it could really come into its own in a game with only one player, adding even more depth to a game mechanic that's principally intended to support the creation of your stronghold. I love the idea of the stronghold, akin to the Ark in Mutant Year Zero, but unless your GM is very generous, and we all know that Matt isn't, it's something that really opens up later in a campaign, as your characters begin to build up enough treasure or income to pay for the high costs of having a stronghold. But if you wanted to go solo, there is one area that's going to cause you trouble, and that's travelling. Remember, each quarter day, a character can do one, or sometimes two, combined actions.
everyone can hike, and you can combine that with either lead the way or keep watch. But critically, for an explorer going solo, not both. If you fail, or don't even attempt to lead the way, you suffer a mishap, ranging from simple blocked terrain to fog, or at worst, blundering into the den of a savage animal that attacks you. Not good. But then, if you fail, or don't even attempt, to keep watch, you fail to spot any random encounters the GM may, or will, roll for you. Keep watch is also useful when you do anything else, so a solo traveller will never be able to do this while doing any other action, like make camp, forage, rest, and sleep. That all sounds a bit tough to me. So how am I to GM modify this to make it more manageable for a single player? Well, I reckon there are a few things that you could consider. First, and easiest, give the character a servant or an entourage. These NPCs could then fulfill these roles, and you don't need to tinker with the rules at all. But if your player is determined to go it alone, well, don't modify a thing, and see how that plays out. This might be a bit harsh, but again, doesn't need any house ruling, and it might be fun to see how long a lone character would survive. Or you could allow the character to do two travelling actions, but at a negative on both. After all, you could go foraging whilst keeping watch, but you'd find it harder to find forage, as you're always looking over your shoulder. And you'd be worse at spotting trouble, as you'd always have one eye to the ground looking for food. So perhaps a minus two dice modifier to both rolls sounds reasonable. You could also apply this to any other action you wanted to double up, remembering that you can already double up hike with keep watch or lead the way. Is there an action you can't really double up? Well, I think sleep is probably the only one. If you're alone and asleep, then there's no one to keep watch. And you have to sleep at some time or another, and it won't always be in the comfy confines of a warm tavern or behind some high stone walls. And even then you might want to keep watch, depending on how friendly the town is. A kind GM might allow you to take longer to make camp, 2 quarter days instead of 1. Okay, so your journeys take longer, but you might have a better hope of living to tell the tale. This extra time to make camp might represent you finding a great hidey hole to build your camp in, or setting some rudimentary traps that would snap and alert you to the arrival of something sneaking up on you. It might not stop the beastly thing getting right on top of you, but at least the first you'd hear of it won't be when it's eating your donkey. In dice terms, I think I'd let you make 2 rolls to make camp, and add all the successes up into 1 total. Not forgetting that you might be at a -2 dice modifier anyway, if you're keeping watch whilst you make camp. 1 success means you have only managed to make a normal camp. You didn't find anywhere really suitable, and your traps all look a bit weak to you. In game terms, you made camp, but your camp failed its keep watch roll. You can then choose to sleep and hope for the best, or stay awake, keep watch yourself, and become sleepy. 2 successes means your camp is perfect, and anything sneaking up on you in your sleep will trip your traps. In game terms, your camp has made its keep watch roll. 3 or more successes, and I'd be tempted, as a GM, to say that one of your traps has caught someone, or something, in the night, and they are now stuck, and in your power.
That was great, Dave, and I think what's interesting about your take on this is you really tried to think about what are the principles of Forbidden Lands that make it not just any old fantasy role-playing game? What are the things that make Forbidden Lands unique, and how do we try and protect those things in this play? So obviously, Forbidden Lands is very much about hex crawling. Yeah, you could ignore the hex crawling entirely and possibly give somebody a few more skills and let them do that, but
yeah, having read the stuff on G+, I wasn't attracted to the idea of just making your character a bit more OP.
Yeah.
In order to deal with it, because like so that a kind of it doesn't defeat the point, but it means you kind of skirt around some of the other parts of the game that actually you ought to lean more into. I think, I mean, you know, the traveling dynamic and the hex crawling thing is one of the things that really attracts me to the game. The stronghold and the whole entourage, coterie, having a group of henchmen thing is another thing that really attracts me to the game. So let's make the most of them.
Yeah, and I think that idea, you know, I think with a bit of thought, actually, one could create a... this is entirely off the top of my head, since you mentioned the entourage, and I wasn't really planning on talking about that, but I think you're right. That's a very simple way, is rather than have multiple characters, there's some sort of rule set for your entourage, so they don't necessarily just stay in your stronghold and look after that.
Yeah.
You might have a couple of people who come with you on your adventures.
Yeah.
But they very much, they're not characters in their own right. The GM doesn't really control them. You're controlling them in some way through, I don't know, charisma dice rolls or something like that that shows your leadership of them.
Yeah.
When you ask them to do a thing. You could not necessarily send them into battle. They might be looking to you to be the defender.
I think they would be sort of partly controlled by the player and partly controlled by the GM. And I think that brings sort of story ideas or story potentials into it,
yeah.
Which could be that, you know, one of them, you know, these are a bit like Doctor Who's companions, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, one of them, you know, Turlough, going back in the
yes.
day,
yeah.
who was
showing your age there,
Peter Davison, but he was probably the best companion they've ever had in Doctor Who.
No, Sarah Jane, obviously.
Sarah Jane, but Turlough was a traitor. Yeah, he was working for the Master
all along,
and that was great. So I like the idea that you can have that little entourage, but actually they're not just sort of automatons who are just doing what you say. They are characters in their own right, but they're non-player characters.
But they could be. I mean, you know, given the sort of procedural nature of a lot of Forbidden Lands, there could be tables and dice rolls that one could create that predicts
about loyalty
of
and stuff.
Yeah,
I think that's a really.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe that's for next time. I could look at that because I think that's a really good idea. Because I think you could really, really explore that part of the game, and it's even more important for a single player.
Yeah.
Than it might be for a group.
Now, one of the things about single player games, you and I both are official playtesters of the Gumshoe 1-to-1 system.
Yeah.
We playtested Robin D. Law's game, Cthulhu Confidential. And that is a Gumshoe game, but it's a specific version of the Gumshoe system called Gumshoe 1-to-1. It's specifically designed to be played with one GM and one player. It's a detective story, so that's the principle that it's following, and part of the ways around you only having one player in that is you've got a network of contacts that you can ask particular things of.
Mm.
But also fundamentally, and this is really true for a detective story, it's really hard to die in that game, because of course death doesn't get you to the end of a detective story. Finding out what happened gets you to the end of a detective story.
Yes.
Dying halfway there, even if you roll up another character, you know, that's another character who in theory doesn't know about the past. So it makes it, you can be really damaged by this game. You can die, but you generally will only die after you've discovered the end.
At the end, yeah.
Now, this game principle works a bit differently, because I think very much part of the principles of this game is you can die. So a story that means that you die alone in the plane somewhere, having made a silly mistake, is still a good story. I mean, it's not necessarily a massively satisfying one for a player. But have you thought at all about whether actually you want to make it as easy to die as it currently is in Forbidden Planet, or as easy to be broken?
Forbidden Planet. Forbidden Lands.
Forbidden Lands, yeah.
So I think there's two things there. One, I had thought similarly about the idea, I think, of boosting a character's stats. You could, if you wanted, as a GM, have some kind of backstory that the character has been, you know, blessed by some wizard or something, and so, you know, you give them more lives.
Hmm.
So, you know, when they die, maybe, you know, three times or two times, they, you know, 12 hours later, they come back to life because they've got this magic infused in them, which would allow the player to die, which is going to happen.
Hmm.
But not end the story there and then. So you've got a sense of that. But that's a bit kind of, you know, it's a bit...
I honestly can't think of the word you're looking for. Not a clue.
It's too much of a hack. You know, you know, the hand of God comes down and says, I don't like the way that's
it's
gone.
It's a bit of a deus ex machina.
Yes, thank you. That'll do. We got there in the end. I might edit out that 30 seconds or I'm not finding a word. So I don't think it feels great from that point of view, but it could work as a one-off, perhaps. Yeah. The other thing is, I think for the GM, if you're not going to make the fights really easy, the outcome of the fight just might need to be different. So in a lot of games, the outcome of a fight, when you lose, you're dead. In this game, as with all Year Zero games, more than likely, you're going to be broken rather than dead. And that means you're out of the fight, but you're not killed. So that then can lead on to lots of other opportunities for the story to develop. But I think a GM will have to be conscious of the fact that, okay, in every fight, there's a reasonable chance that my one player is going to be broken.
Mm.
What happens after they're broken? I mean, if they're broken by a pack of wolves, then the wolves are likely to eat them.
Yeah.
If they're broken by a bandit, the bandit might just rob them.
Yes.
And leave them to die.
But they might not die.
No. So,
of course, being broken in this game, though, you do have to roll on the crits table, and the crits table may kill you.
Yes. Yes, that is very true.
Unless we did a slightly different crits table that maybe, like the Gumshoe one-to-one system, is only going to kill you later, or has a reduced chance of killing you. Still a chance of killing you outright.
So again, it's interesting, isn't it? The thing I find, particularly with Coriolis and all these games, is when as a GM you get to the point that something's happened, someone's been a bit stupid and they've been shot or they've been stabbed or something.
And there's a crit,
well, including me, yes. And there's a crit roll coming, or there's an option for a crit roll. As a GM, I try and pick my moments for doing the crits, and there needs to be a reason for it, because when I roll the dice, that character may be dead.
Yeah.
You know, half a second later. So I think you have to pick those moments, and it really builds up the tension in the game. And I think the players enjoy it for that.
Mm.
With one player, it becomes binary, doesn't it? It's either, you know, I'm going to be lucky and survive, or game's over.
Yeah.
So you have to be quite careful, again, as a GM, to crit your single player. Although, as I said, in Forbidden Lands, when you get broken, the crit just happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And as the same with Mutant Year Zero. So it's not such a choice in that sense.
But then maybe there is a Forbidden Lands one-to-one crit table that's a bit different.
Yeah.
It gives you conditions, maybe.
Mm.
Like in Gumshoe one-to-one, you get a card that says, from now on, this is your disadvantage.
Yes.
And obviously it's Cthulhu, so there's a lot of disadvantage about going crazy. But it doesn't stop you being entirely functional until the end of the adventure. Now here...
That is quite a big change, isn't it, though? So it is quite a hack of the rules.
Yeah.
But it might be the right thing to do. But some people might not want to have to do such a big house rule.
And also, there isn't, you know, the key difference about this is very much a procedural game. That is, you know, the outcome are defined a lot more by dice than by there being a secret, a story that you have to find out.
Yeah.
Like you do in a detective story.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that really attracts me. I was thinking, again, with my group in the week, doing Forbidden Lands, but then making every scenario just designed by the dice rolls.
Yeah.
Don't do any thinking at all. Just let the dice decide what's going
to
happen.
And, you know, the last adventure we ran, which I'm so cross that we failed to record, that was effectively done that way.
That was great, that was really good.
So it does work. It's a game that works like that. So one of the things that was suggested online is you just get successes on fives or sixes. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't like that.
No, for me, that doubles the chance. That seems to be a massive change to the probability.
Yeah. Even if as was suggested online, that five is a partial success. Well, actually, 1-6 is supposed to be a partial success.
Yes.
Anyway. So no, I don't... Not for me. It might be for some, but not for me.
Yeah. What about the multitasking thing?
I like it. I think that works. And I think it still fits the feel of the game. Because actually, if you're leading the way whilst you're hiking, the rules as stated don't allow you to do anything else. But if you're leading the way, surely you're kind of keeping watch at the same time, potentially. The two things are pretty similar in the activity you'll actually be doing. So I do wonder whether you could allow not just doubling up of those actions, but tripling up. So when you're hiking, you could lead the way and keep watch, but perhaps each roll there would then be on a minus three dice.
Yeah,
or I mean, that's a lot of like that's when, a lot of dice.
When you're crewing in Coriolis and you've got a ship that's too big for your crew,
yes,
if you do more than one task in a space combat, you take a minus two on both the tasks that you do.
Yeah, and then a cumulative minus two as well. Yeah. So that
or minus one, I can't remember that.
No, it's minus two. Yeah. You're right. I guess my feel for Forbidden Lands, my sense is that your dice pools are slightly smaller. Is that just because I've been playing with characters that have now got quite a lot of experience and have got extra dice because they've spent experience on skills and things? Is there any reason why? I don't think there is. Maybe not. So perhaps a minus three dice negative is acceptable. The other thing you could do is say that the action takes twice as long. So the hike, you'd hike the distance you would in one quarter, but in two quarters if you are leading the way and keeping watch.
Yeah.
Which would then might reduce the negative to minus two.
Because I can't remember there being massive advantages to getting multiple successes on either
of
those tasks.
No, they're not.
So if you got multiple successes, would you get a free keeping watch as well as a lead the way?
Potentially. That's a bit like my making camp and keeping watch thing, isn't it? Where the successes you get on the rolls that you make then dictate how well you've done it. And if you do really well, your traps are so good that anybody who does blunder into your camp gets captured, gets caught in the trap. So that could work. But I quite like, having thought about it from a single player point of view, I quite like some of the things I've come up with. And I think we might have a discussion offline about whether you might want to include some of those in our bigger game. Because I think... Did you know the bit where I said that you're not a generous GM?
You're just
proving my point yet again. Or maybe if I run a Forbidden Lands campaign with the guys down the pub, then maybe I'll do it. Because I think it makes sense.
Yeah. Actually. Well, to be honest, actually, I think there's an interesting thing there about if you've rolled up in Legends and Adventurers an entirely random character and you end up with a party who are not necessarily able between them to do all the functions.
Yeah.
I might be more generous then, but probably not.
Rob,
this is a post-apocalyptic fantasy world. It's meant to be tough.
It is, yeah.
You are all going to die.
And that was the other thing. You could just try running a one-player game with the rules as written and see how it goes.
Yeah.
And it would then be incumbent upon the player to be much more careful.
Well, there's a thing, actually. I did think about this. Conan. And I don't mean Conan the role-playing game. I mean Conan the books.
Yeah.
There is a character that's done pretty much everything on his own. And it dawned on me that although we think of Conan as the big, muscly sword fighter guy, actually, if you read the books, Conan does an awful lot of sneaking around.
Yeah.
So if I were doing a one-to-one with you, and I were allowed not to use Legends and Adventures, but to design my own character, I think I'd be designing a sneaky character.
Yeah.
When you're on your own, sneaky is where you want to be.
Yeah.
Let's face it, fighting is all about being with your mates, basically, having somebody to cover your flanks.
Yep.
If you're on your own, you haven't got that.
No.
Or at least fighting... Conan did later on in his adventures, but he started off as a thief.
Yeah.
And that's what we should be thinking about. Sneaky characters who see the giant spider and sneak around the giant spider. And they've got really good dice balls for doing that.
And they only fight having to do when they absolutely have to. Yeah. When it's life or death and they've been cornered.
That's what I'd do.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Brilliant.
Cool. Excellent.
So, Tom, thank you for... I mean, you didn't ask us specifically, but it was a great question to put on the internet. Yeah. And we've had about half an hour's content out there.
Yeah.
So, well done. Well done, Tom.
Well done, Tom.
I don't even know whether he listens to the show.
No, very well better do now. We'll send him a message and say, listen, we're talking about you.
So, next in our line, we have got...
It's your piece, Matt, about your strange creatures that are inhabiting the Star Singer.
No, the Siren.
The Siren. Well, the reason I chose Star Singer for the name is that it's... relevant to one of the icons. One of the icons was referred to the Star Singer.
Yeah, no, I'm entirely happy with Star Singer.
So if you want to take it away from the context of the game, that's fine.
No. It's just that when this thing happened, this idea with this duality of the AI, suddenly, I've been looking for a scenario upon which to hang the title Song to the Siren after one of my favourite songs, which you must listen to. This Mortal Coil, YouTube it. It's for me, it really feels very Coriolis, that song. Anyway.
Let's listen to what you had to say.
Let's not, don't listen to that music until you've listened finished. To what I've had to say.
Yeah, exactly. Then we can talk about it afterwards.
People listening to our most recent Coriolis actual play may have picked up on a few references. From a start and a bad guy inspired by the movie The Bad Batch, through Scavengers, modelled after Steptoe and Son, which our American listeners may know better as Sanford and Son, to a wrecked ship, absolutely and openly based on the Liberator from Blake Seven. But when it came to the creatures infesting that ruined ship, it was the Coriolis rulebook I turned to. I didn't really find what I was looking for, but I did find some inspiration, and this is the story of how I riffed on that inspiration, fudged the details, and tested my half-formed ideas in play. The inspiration came from a creature that was almost what I wanted. The Darkbound are regular people that are somehow claimed by the dark between the stars, as the core book says. Until that point, I hadn't decided whether the creatures I wanted were native to the planet, creatures of the darkness, or, as suggested here, fellow prisoners who are somehow changed. And given that the adventure is partly about how prisoners are changed by exile, it struck me, on reading about the Darkbound, it was suddenly obvious that my creatures should be changed prisoners. The description of the Darkbound seemed perfect too, looking, and I quote, like a thin and twisted human, with only a few torn patches of hair left, and with burning eyes and long claws instead of fingers. But the real inspiration came from their mystic power. They only have one, well, arguably, they have a couple, but more on that later. The only power which is actually described mechanically is Night Veil. I won't quote it here, but in short, it's a mental attack. It does not deal out mind point damage, but it does make it difficult to think with a -2, that's a -2 modifier, for rolls on observation, advanced skills, and initiative. Now, I didn't actually use that attack per se, but the idea suddenly made sense of what my creatures were, how they came to be, and the nature of the AI, Kadim, and the ship itself. Fans of Blake Seven may remember the ship's computer, Zen. When I started planning my adventure, I imagined an advanced AI, like Zen, having been ripped out of its ship, enlisting the PCs to get him fitted back in. The Darkbound's mystic power unlocked a deluge of different, better ideas. What if the relationship between Kadim and the ship was more complex? What if Kadim was the rational, thinking part of the ship, the ego? And when it was ripped out, what was left behind was the id, the instinctive, feeling part. What if both parts of the ship were damaged by the separation? Kadim can calculate and communicate, but it can't really understand the humans it works with because it has to fake empathy. I'm going to say it's autistic, while recognising that's a massive oversimplification of a complex condition. Meanwhile, the ship, which Dave called Star Singer, but I am going to call Siren, can feel and emote. It can run subroutines and try to repair itself, but it can't really communicate. It moans, it sings its despair, and it's that which makes it difficult to think. It's not a mystic attack at all. The longer you spend in the ship, the closer you get to where Kadim had been ripped out, the harder it becomes to make a wits roll. Mechanically, I ran this as a -2 penalty to any wits-based skill roll when they're in the chamber, which is equivalent to the bridge, but I think I'd recommend doing it differently in future. So these creatures are not the perpetrators of the mind-dimming effect, but its victims. Previous salvagers who spent too long in the vessels and literally lost their wits. It's more than that, though. They have been transformed in other ways by prolonged exposure to the song of the siren. They have become automata, part of the ship's systems. I wanted the alien technology to feel properly alien, unknowable. I wanted it to be composed of strange, sealed units that would be absolutely baffling to my engineer. So, I imagined these creatures' bodies were so changed by the influence of the siren, no longer eating, sustained only by the song, that they are almost ethereal. They can reach into the strange machinery of the ship to maintain and to operate it. They also needed to be a threat to the PCs, though, and I had stolen their only mystic power to use as a more general effect. Well, I say it's their only power, and if you look at their stat block, it's the only one listed. But the description mentions a couple of others. They, quote, move incredibly fast, closing in on their victims in the blink of an eye to sink their claws into them, and, I quote again, just the touch of a dark bound can paralyze someone completely. So, I treated their touch like a paralyzing poison, activating it not on just the touch, but when they actually do damage to a PC. I didn't want them to be too aggressive, though, so I wanted some sort of trigger for an attack. Thinking back to the separation of Kadeem's ego from the siren's id, I decided that they would only attack when a PC would try to reason with them, talk to them. So unused were they to communicating in anything other than the raw emotion of the siren. I like the idea that they might now be integral to the operation of the ship, and that, if they managed to get off planet in the siren, the PCs would have to put up with them scuttling around and also remember not to talk when they were nearby. So, I was done. However, testing them in play, I decided that, for our ill-equipped adventurers, the paralysis power could be not dangerous exactly, but not fun. Combined with their natural speed, I saw that it could easily create a situation when the whole party was paralysed. And though they might not be dead, why would the creatures kill them if they were quiet? It might be a very frustrating experience. And the scenario was already frustrating enough. So I am thinking instead about a mystic power which, for the cost of a darkness point, allows them to ignore the effects of PC armour, and maybe for another DP makes it easy for them to inflict unarmed crits. Finally, I needed a name, because I feel these creatures are now quite different from the Darkbound that inspired them. I have called them Abdelred. A corruption of an Arabic word that means simply crew.
I really like that, Matt, and I particularly love your idea about the duality of the ship. I think having the idea that Kadeem has been torn out of the ship and it's two halves of, you know, the yin and yang of the ship is great. I really, really think that worked really well. The other thing I really like is the idea of the crew, as it were, the creatures on board, actually not being aggressive or dangerous or danger, wrong word, but not being inherently out to, you know, protect the ship or eat people who come on board, but just being part of it, and then they react when they hear things that are there in a kind of automatic way. They don't mean to be nasty.
Yeah.
But they and I love the idea, you know, if we eventually manage to get off the prison planet with this ship, that, you know, we have this crew going around the ship and we have to be sort of mindful of what we're doing around that. I think that's a really good idea. I like that very much.
Yeah, well, you know, when I looked again at Blake 7, actually, after we were talking about the Liberator, and actually I feel... Well, there's a number of... Let me talk about Blake 7 for a minute. By God, it's crap.
It's very dated, isn't it?
It's really, really dated now. You can see it all on YouTube, as far as I think, but it feels like I mean, particularly the special effects on the prison ship, the London.
Yes.
It looks like something that came out of Buck Rogers, for Christ's sake, from the 30s.
Well, it's like the kind of thing that me and my brother used to do with our Super 8 camera back in the 70s. With a bit of wire.
Cheesy stuff.
Well, I guess the budgets weren't so high, were they?
No, the budgets were not high at all. And it really looks like, you know, all the interior sets on there, it's like, you can have half the studio because we've got Blue Peter happening over there, but you can have the kind of broom cupboard. And so the bridge is this awful, you know, it doesn't look like a bridge at all. It looks like, well, let's bung a bunch of mixing desks up on the wall, and then we'll have to walk around those rather uncomfortably. Anyway, so there's that. Let's just get over that. Oh, the spacesuits, they're environment suits as well. They've got these old 1960s motorcycle helmets with a little bit of wire going around in front of their face, like it's
okay.
Rant over, but by God, it's crap. But fundamentally, it was disappointing because these guys are meant to have found some sort of alien warship. And it begins quite well. It's got this weird defence mechanism, which Andy in the game was convinced, once you'd all twigged it was the Liberator, he was convinced you guys are going to be affected by that, which was this sort of thing, again, that does a mental attack on you, gives you hallucinations. And then that, you know, they go, no, ignore it, it's not real. And it's gone, they shoot it as well. But then it's gone forever. Then there's a wonderful bit of Jenna, the pilot, getting stuck to some sort of plate, and I think we're meant to understand from that her brain is being downloaded into Zen, because then Zen starts talking to her, or talking to the crew in English, and he knows all about them. And so this opening of it being really alien and strange, but then it becomes entirely functional.
Yeah.
And...
Well, I guess they probably didn't want it to be in the way of the story.
No, but for this... I want it to be really alien and strange. I want it to always be really alien and strange.
Yeah.
And Coriolis lends itself to weirdness.
Alien and strange.
And so I'm really interested. I'm not really sure whether this is a ship you're necessarily going to want to keep.
No.
Because, you know, one of the things, I want to make it difficult for you to be an engineer on it. Mm. Really difficult for you to be an engineer. And so that's why I kept talking about these sealed units you just couldn't get your head around.
Yeah.
And
I can imagine, you know, Yaphet trying to do engineering on that ship with the crew. What are they? The Abdelard. Being a bit like trying to do something at home with my new puppy.
Yes.
Constantly something in the way. Just you can never get anything done.
Yeah. Now I think it's the sort of thing where you'd have to be asking. Obviously, first of all, you need to reinstate Kadeem into the ship, so Kadeem and Siren work together, and then the more helpful version of Kadeem that will be there because he's got emotional as well as
more helpful implies that he's been helpful because he hasn't so far.
He's been helpful.
He's been a stubborn git so far.
The less stubborn version of Kadeem will work with you. And then, you know, I don't imagine there's a way of you being able, you know, ever to get the Abdelard to do stuff from verbal instruction. Verbal instruction will get you...
Attacked. Yeah.
But particularly not really Kadeem, but Siren, the ship itself. You know, if you ask Kadeem to do something, Siren will send these guys to
do it.
To do the fiddling about the machinery, I think.
That's
my plan.
So Yaphet's got an engineering crew.
I think so. But like kind of remote control drones, almost like robots rather than the crew.
Yeah.
But weird, vaguely see-through humans that used to be human.
Yeah.
And I think probably, you know, I'm hypothecating on what the portal builders were, but you had that brilliant idea when you designed the ship that there was no gravity on board because these guys didn't need gravity.
Yeah.
But also, I kind of see them, well, you know, they just reach into a machine and change it.
Yeah.
In a way, so they don't need controls. So, so that's it. I don't want to specify too much about what they are because, again, I want them to be alien and unknowable.
Yeah.
But I think this crew can be your way then of adapting the ship. And, you know, in a way, this is why. So I'm telling you how to play the next half of the scenario. So I shouldn't really be doing this. But yeah, this is why it's been so difficult for previous generations of prisoners to not just take the ship and fly off.
Yeah.
It's not just about your engineering skill and the potential skill, but I think your understanding.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting point that you're saying that this might be a ship, if we manage to get it off the planet, might be a ship that we won't want to keep.
Yeah.
Because it's just a bit weird. And I've definitely got, through that scenario, I definitely have an uncomfortable feeling about the ship.
Yeah.
Even though it's potentially our passage off the prison planet. There's definitely, I'm unsettled by it, which is, I think from what you're saying, exactly what you were
exactly
trying
to... Exactly what I was trying to do.
Trying to get. Yes. Yeah, that's good. Because it doesn't feel very homely.
No,
it's not like the place, you know. It's
and
not,
I think you can, you will adapt that if you want to, but
put
again,
some nice furnishings in, you know, a big
you'll
IKEA
order. You'll be creating
order.
Spaces within spaces. So yeah. There'll be the functional bits of the ship, and then you'll try and make a home of it, but it won't... I don't think it'll ever be gravity. I don't know whether you're convinced.
I'd have to install graviton projectors and stuff. Then
yeah,
I
or you know, there may be the wherewithal to make gravity in the ship.
But yeah,
they just haven't needed it, and then they've got to deal with the surfaces because there aren't any necessarily surfaces for people to walk around. You're just walking around round tubes all the time. So yeah, I want to make it uncomfortable for you.
Yeah, in which case gravity might be a disadvantage on board because you wouldn't be able to get anywhere.
Yeah,
because. So it's a good opportunity to practice our zero-G movement skills.
Cool.
Excellent. No, but that's really good. And I really look forward to playing the next scenario, whenever that'll be, because obviously we're going to do Forbidden Lands next, aren't we?
Yes. But, yeah, so that might, I guess, possibly be next time we're in Norfolk.
It might be, yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about listening to that, I actually thought, you know, this, I really like this scenario quite a lot. And
I've only listened to the first episode we put out and then a bit of the second.
Right.
But I love that opening. I mean, I had to listen to it just because I remember the feeling of satisfaction that the plan worked.
Yes.
You know, everything came off and we worked it out well and, you know, I...
Well, there's a crazy thing, actually. I have to show you this just to prove that I did this thing. Because remember, I didn't expect you to necessarily win. I was thinking you were going to somehow negotiate with these guys or...
Just get captured.
Get captured. And then I imagined you'd be going back to the place where the
Salvage Town, or it was called.
Yeah, where the cannibals live, effectively. Yeah. But remember, you didn't do that. And so then you asked for all sorts of things like, oh, what are the names of these people? And I don't know what the names of the people are. And let's roll someone, because you're not even, you weren't meant to bring. Actually, I'd written the names of these prisoners down.
Okay.
they're not the names I gave you.
No.
But I thought, well, in Salvage Tower, they will meet these guys. And I just randomly rolled them from the book in advance. And I thought, oh, but why didn't I use these? And you've thrown me so much by that one hit that I then thought, oh, well, I don't know what's happening in the story.
It was particularly good. It's nice just to have a plan and work out all the bits and bobs and use a few skills.
Yeah.
Use my gearhead talent, my blessing.
Yes.
Give it to the guy who's best off to do it. And then, yeah,
it was
great.
It was great. And then that great 66. I know. Just when you want it.
Yeah, the dice do make it sometimes, don't they? They really.
But I was thinking, actually, as I listened, you know, and looking at stuff like this, that I've got, well, you know, here's a location. You know, this might be a nice thing to put together into a package for other people to play.
Yeah.
And obviously, we could just do that. I could write it up. It would take a bit of work, because you can see, look at my notes. My notes are shit.
They are. Comprehensive isn't the word I would use.
Yeah.
But that's all you need there as a GM, isn't it? So,
your imagination.
Yeah.
Or that's generally the way I fly.
Yeah.
Or by the seat of my pants. Sometimes I don't even have that many notes. Don't tell Dave, though, because he'll be really pissed off. Oh, no, you are, Dave!
We noticed that when he's been half the morning reading the fucking scenario. Anyway...
Which one was that?
Oh, you do that all the time.
Do I?
Yeah. Over the years.
You've got used to it.
Well, I've learned to work around it, I guess.
Where am I going with this? So anyway, I thought we could...
I think you're going open game license conversation.
Yeah, I'm going open game
you?
License. Yeah, there we go. So, you know, obviously I couldn't type all this up and just stick it online and stick it on my blog or whatever, but the open game license is coming.
Indeed. So I've got a few things that I want to put together for that. I don't have a sense yet. I was going to mail Nils just to ask, what kind of formats and what...
So I imagine with the open game license.
How do I take my lovely content, such as it may be, and put it into a format that...
I imagine the open game license will come out with a bunch of assets.
Yes.
So they're obviously doing... They're going to do it in line with...
Templates, kind of thing.
Drive-through RPG, yep. Which allows you to produce a PDF and then sell it through some sort of storefront where all that stuff will be gathered together.
Yep.
And so things like... what they call the Dungeon Masters Guild, which is a sort of separate section of DRGP,
yep.
Drive-through for D&D content. And I imagine there'll be these resources that we can put into a desktop publishing program and make it look a bit of a family. And there'll definitely be some sort of logo that says
Open Game Zero compatible. Yeah.
That sort of thing. And there'll be a bunch of terms of use about how you use that sort of stuff. So there's that. And some of those... For example, the one for Unknown Armies is quite prescriptive in how you format stuff.
Okay. Well, I don't really mind how they want it formatted. Mm. I just want a nice, easy, user-friendly mechanism for doing that.
Yeah, we might not. We'll have to see how user-friendly it is.
Yeah.
For example, they might all imagine that everybody's got Adobe InDesign and the assets only work with that, but I hope not.
Is that expensive?
It's really expensive.
Yeah.
And it's by subscription only now as well.
Oh, God, I hate
pain
that.
Pain in the ass, yeah. So we'll have to wait and see about
Adobe
that.
Adobe InDesign, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's see. So, I mean, hopefully... I mean, I've got at least two things that I could fairly quickly scrub up and put out on that, and that's the Trade in the Horizon.
Yeah.
And obviously Tango Tango 82.
And there seems to be a lot of demand for Trading on the Horizon.
It does, yeah. I know. I'm kind of in two minds about whether to just chuck out what I've got anyway on my blog or wait for the open game license to put it out more professionally, depending on how long that's going to take. Do we have a sense of when that's going to come out?
Well,
I haven't heard anything.
We got that little nod from Nils on G Plus saying who is interested.
Yeah.
And
he was talking about the new year, wasn't he? But,
and it's the new year, and we're in the new year now. It's now January. We've not had anything since.
No.
I think it might be time to give him a shout.
Nils!
No, we'll get him. I'm suggesting maybe we get him on the next podcast.
That's a good idea.
To talk about it.
That's a very good idea, actually. Yeah.
And or Thomas or whoever's actually running the OGL bit.
Yeah.
We'll drop him a line. The other thing I wondered about is actually we've got a bunch of content on our blogs that we've done so far.
We have.
Generally transcripts of what we've been talking about here. I did wonder, Kickstarter are doing a thing for RPGers in February, which is they're trying to encourage people to do old-style fanzines.
Right.
They're insisting it can only be printed in one colour, or they can use different colour paper and stuff like that. But there's a real feel of...
Retro feel
to it. And I just wondered whether we could repurpose some of our blog content, expand it a little bit.
Into a fanzine.
And do a fanzine. And that might be a fun way of us launching the OGL content.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's quite a lot there. We could. It wouldn't be just a leaflet, would it?
No.
You know, it might be a pamphlet.
It might rather
than a booklet.
It might even be a booklet. And I just thought, you know, years and years ago, we started our collaboration together. On Songs of Blood and Sorrow,
we did.
Your Judge Dredd scenario. And just part of me is kind of going, maybe it's time to do
dust
that
off again.
Yeah.
Do it. Yeah. So the first, edition one of Songs of Blood and Sorrow was, 1985?
What?
Something like that.
That was the final edition, Songs of Blood and
edition
Sorrow.
Edition two would be 2019.
Well, maybe
we ought to get slightly more frequent in issuing the fanzine if we're going to do it.
But there's a thing I'm interested to know just how Coriolis is covered within the OGL.
Yeah.
Because let us remind ourselves that actually Fialagan don't own the IP for Coriolis.
Mm.
So although they own, they can easily give us the mechanics of the Coriolis game, because that's something they do own, how much actual Coriolis content we're allowed to make and whether we're allowed to brand it Coriolis and
yes.
that sort of stuff,
yeah.
we have to wait and see.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So...
That's interesting, just as a side, as a tangent on that, I think I'm going to start using, in my Coriolis games, the Forbidden Lands mental crypt table. Because they've got the horror crypt table in there. And I think that's one thing that Coriolis is missing.
Well, it's one of the things, I'm just interested on talking those aliens, that there is a sort of mental attack, but it doesn't affect your mind points at all.
No.
and you've got quite a lot of mind points. It's a difficult thing to invent, unless, of course, as somebody pointed out on the internet, unless you shoot a min-maxed soldier who's put all his points in body with a stun gun and then knock him out straight away.
But even then, he's going to have at least four, isn't he? Probably five.
Yeah. So, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I think having a sort of mind point crit, I think that either a stun weapon could do that or...
Or some of the horrors of a particular
horrific thing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that makes sense. So I'm going to have a look at that, and I might just use the one that's in the back of the Forbidden Lands book.
Now, I'm going to challenge you. We've got content we need to produce for this. So how about for the next podcast, you work out properly how you'd use that mechanic in combat.
Wasn't I going to do something else?
So I'm going to challenge you, Dave. I'm going to challenge you. You've got a choice now. But for one of these things, you have to produce for the next programme. Either you do those one-to-one Forbidden Lands henchman mechanics that we talked about at the beginning of the programme, or you do the applying mental crits from Forbidden Lands to Coriolis. One of those two things in the next podcast, and the other one of those two things in the podcast after that. Two bits of homework.
Done.
Cool.
Excellent.
And I guess that brings us to the end of our show.
So I haven't got any homework for you, though, have I?
No, it's okay. I can invent my own homework. I've got plenty of homework. Remember, you came to me for inspiration before this.
That's true. That was a very good idea as well from John Friendly, or whatever you called him. Tom Pleasant.
Jonathan Friendly. He's a lovely guy.
That's not a bad name, actually, is it? Jonathan Friendly. Anyway.
No, in fact, he might appear in a future scenario. It may be my Western character.
That's a good idea. Excellent. Or if it's not, there'll be an NPC called Jonathan Friendly who is anything but.
I'm all for that. Cool. Well, brilliant. So that's a lot to look forward to in the next episode. What are we going to do about the Grindbone Challenge?
We need to
edit that down into
an episode. Yeah, absolutely.
And what about the Simba Room Adventure?
I've got a Simba Room Adventure also to edit.
So you're going to be easier to edit on the Simba Room?
Yeah, probably.
What's the next AP? Because we're now out of APs.
Yeah, well, I can. If you want to work on the Grindbone thing, I'll do the Simba Room. We've got probably four or five episodes of that to come out. And then obviously this one.
Yes. So this will be coming out, obviously, after we've edited it, which will be when you listen to it, because you'll be listening to it.
It is early, guys. So,
and then in a couple of weeks from now, but probably a week or so from when you're listening, there'll be probably Simba Room.
I should be able to get that out. Yeah.
So I think Grindbone will take a little bit longer, and we probably need to come back for a recording session. Yes, as well.
I think the Grindbone one, the tournament we did at Dragon Meet, which is obviously quite a long time ago now, but we need to pick out the best bits because there's about 2.5 hours of recording there, and some of it might not be the best quality. So we want to pick out the best bits, and then maybe do a little bit of match of the day comments from me and Matt.
Yeah.
From Gary Lineker and Mark Chapman.
And Matt.
Okay. So yeah, we've got quite a lot to come.
So in the meantime, I think it's time to say goodbye.
It is. Goodbye. And may the icons bless your adventures.
Yay!
Bye.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by FontFabric.